as chief of staff. What he's done in terms of homeland security is record-shattering. You look at the border, you look at the tremendous results we've had, and you look at the spirit. And with a very controversial situation, there's been very little controversy, which is pretty amazing by itself. So I want to congratulate you on having done a fantastic job, General, and we look forward to, if it's possible, an even better job as Chief of Staff.
That's right, sir. Thank you.
President Trump swearing in retired Marine General John Kelly this morning as his Chief of Staff. He replaces Reince Priebus, who was pushed out late Friday, and he has wasted no time, John Kelly, in making changes. That's right, the mooch is out.
What I don't like about Washington is people do not let you know how they feel. They're very nice to your face, and then they take a shiv or a machete and they stab it in your back. I don't like it. You know, Anthony,
okay,
I'm a Wall Street guy, and I'm more of a front-stabbing person, and I'd rather tell people directly how I feel about them than this sort of nonsense.
Well, have you heard
directly? All right, that's Anthony Scaramucci just days ago on Fox. He resigned as communications director after just about 11 days on the job. Julian Zelizer is a history professor at Princeton University. He joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin with your reaction to the departure of Anthony Scaramucci.
Well, it strikes me that it's evidence of the kind of challenge that Kelly faces. I mean, this is how low the bar is at this point, that a communications director who has this kind of interview with the New Yorker was still on the job, and it took a shakeup really now to get him out. So I think this is just the tip of the iceberg, and if Kelly is going to be successful, he's going to have much bigger challenges because of what's going on in the Oval Office.
Right. And so does this tell you what kind of management he'll bring to the White House? I mean, it was just minutes after he was sworn in when this came across.
Well, sure. I mean, again, this is the most obvious thing to do. So my guess is any new chief of staff would have done this. But it's clear that Kelly will try to get rid of some of the sources of public disorder in the White House at the same time that he tries, again, to create some clear line of structure and order in the communications to the president, with him being the gatekeeper.
Okay, so in this situation, though, Anthony Scaramucci had bragged that he reported only to the president, and clearly John Kelly didn't like that chain of command. What do you envision in terms of how John Kelly would be able to stand up to his boss, the president, and, maybe rein him in a little bit?
I think it's going to be incredibly difficult after the first few days. Scaramucci is the sideshow. The main source of the problem is the president himself, and Kelly works for the president, not vice versa. So I don't anticipate any significant change in the way that the president communicates, the way that he speaks. He's been very consistent, not only as president, but his entire public career. So I think all the problems that have existed with this White House, from the tweets to the kind of rhetoric we've heard to the lack of focus, will continue. It's going to be very hard for Kelly to change that. And there's other competing power centers who will not be as easy to remove as Scaramucci, namely family members like Jared Kushner and more prominent advisors and cagey advisors such as Stephen Bannon.
Mm. Okay, well, what has his record been like so far running Homeland Security?
Well, very effective. He has implemented some very controversial policies, as we've heard, and he has created one area of kind of clarity and discipline in how the cabinet and the executive branch works. He's been relatively successful, at least in his interactions with Congress. But all of that is very different than being chief of staff, which in my mind is a much more political job. And it's a job where the relationship with the president is going to be much more important on a daily basis.
Well, what is his reputation on Capitol Hill? And he would presumably have to manage the relationship between the White House and congressional Republicans.
His reputation, he's very clear-headed. He's very mission-oriented. He is not someone who likes to suffer fools. And he is someone who both believes in victory and achieving objectives in a military style, And he will move quickly to do that. But now that's going to be very hard to translate when your boss is President Trump. That's not how President Trump operates. He enjoys the chaos. He enjoys moving from one issue to another and not really paying attention to one single objective over time. So it's going to be a clash of cultures. And he'll have to deal with many more members of Congress on a regular basis in a Congress which is increasingly frustrated and angry with what the president is doing. So I think the two roles are pretty different, and some of the skills he's brought to the table will be harder to implement in this role.
What about the use of the military and in the Trump administration? He has H.R. McMaster as his national security advisor. Of course, he's got Jim Mattis as running the Pentagon. So why do you think President Trump likes to appoint members of the military to these posts?
I think he clearly, the people he respects are military figures, business figures, and his family. This is appealing to him. It's a source of machismo. It's a perception that this is what leadership is about, a very strong figure who can issue commands with force and with gravity. But that said, all the examples you mentioned are interesting in that they've all been around since January. And when they were all brought on, all these military officials, the whole goal was to achieve some kind of discipline for this president. And that hasn't happened yet. So it's a little bit of a warning sign, I think, for the White House that Kelly hasn't been able to achieve this objective yet. And neither have all these other figures, even though Trump is clearly very enamored with this type of figure surrounding him.
So you don't think that he would actually listen to what John Kelly had to say with regards to cutting back on the tweeting and not making surprise announcements about, let's say, members of the military who are transgender, that kind of thing?
He might listen, but I don't think he's going to follow through. I can't imagine that Secretary Mattis or previously Secretary Kelly have been pleased with his tweets on China, North Korea, on many of these issues, and they haven't been able to stop them yet. Obviously, now he's closer to the president on a regular basis, but I think it's going to be very difficult to really transform President Trump. This is who he is, and in some ways, Kelly's best route is to deal with the rest of the Oval Office and the staff rather than with the president himself.
Right. And so that was James Baker's advice, that you can either be the White House part of that title or the chief of staff part of that title, that you can either answer more to your boss or to the staff.
Right.
And it's better to answer to your staff or to focus on your staff than focus on the president.
I think that's particularly true in this case. But at the same time, that will undermine many of his objectives, because from my perspective, a lot of the problems we have been discussing clearly come directly from the president himself. So that Baker strategy is very smart, but I'm not sure it will work to really contain what has become a very chaotic presidency.
And meanwhile, what happens to Homeland Security?
We don't know. Obviously, the big question is if there's an effort to shift Jeff Sessions from attorney general to that position. That's the story that has been out there already causing a lot of controversy. If that happens, I think you're going to have a real heated fight in Washington over his doing that. Other than that, we'll hear in the next few days if that's not the solution, whether the acting secretary will stay on the job or whether he'll try to bring someone else in with some of Kelly's same skills.
All right. We will see. It's only Monday, after all. There's a whole week ahead of us.
Right. See what happens tonight.
Yeah. Julian Zelizer, he's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, it appears this week is continuing the drama from last week. Police departments nationwide are pushing back against President Trump's rough-em-up comments he made last week.
You see these thugs being thrown into the back of a paddy wagon. You just see them thrown in, rough. I said, please don't be too nice.
Well, speaking of the president, he may have to rethink his practice of blocking people he disagrees with on Twitter. A federal court says public officials who do this are violating the First Amendment. Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson is here to talk about both of these stories. Our regular Monday Legal. Hello.
Hello. Let's rough it up.
I know. Woo. Okay. So let's talk about, you know, that comment. He was joking, right? Or at least he says he was joking, or his supporters say he was joking. However, police departments are taking this pretty seriously, including Police Chief Charlie Beck here in L.A.
We've heard this from him a lot of times, where it was candidate Trump and now President Trump will say something that is utterly outrageous and almost advocating for illegal behavior. For instance, in this case, we could read this fairly easily, and I don't think humorlessly, to indicate that he's advocating for excessive force by police officers, which is not permissible under federal law. But he says it in kind of a joking way, and it's in a speech, and it's with a wink and a nod. And so you can take it any way you want, really. But it's important for people to remember, one, that there are protections, there are civil liberty protections against police officers and law enforcement officials. And I think what we've seen in the days since this comment is universal response from police chiefs saying, we will not do this. Police departments are very, very sensitive to these claims. And I think that's why you see, or I've seen, almost universal condemnation.
Okay, so remind us, he said, look, in those comments, he said, you know, when you put your hand on their heads, when you're putting them in the back of the squad car, well, don't do that so much. So remind us, when suspects are being arrested, when it comes to police brutality, what is and what is not allowed?
Well, I mean, you can't use quote unquote excessive force, which means more than necessary. Now, there's a reason that we see in every TV, in every movie where you arrest someone, we see that famous kind of hand grab where you put one hand on top of a suspect's head, because otherwise you can slam someone's head into a car. And many police departments have understood that that would be unnecessary. There's no reason that once someone is restrained, once you can get them into the car, that you need to slam their head against steel. Now, most of the issues come up not once they're restrained, once they're arrested, but really in trying to apprehend someone. So I will lay out kind of a familiar scene. There's someone, you think that you need to talk to them, you think you may need to stop and arrest them, and they have something in their hand. Is it a ballpoint pen? Is it a paper airplane? Is it a gun? And so you decide how much force to use depending on the set of circumstances. And a judge, if it comes to that, will determine whether or not you used unnecessary force in apprehending that person.
Could a criminal defense lawyer use these comments that Donald Trump made as evidence that this was inciting a police officer to act outside the law with regards to his or her client?
I think you could, except what you see, or what I've seen so far, are police departments saying, that's not our policy. Let me repeat, that's not our policy. And trying to protect the police officers and saying, this is not what we do. And we treat people with respect and integrity. So I think that we've very quickly seen the law enforcement community kind of unite and try and say, that's not going to be what we're hearing in court. Is it, well, President Trump told me it was okay.
Okay, let's move on. Speaking of the courts, on this ruling on whether public officials can block users on social media, what did the court say?
So this is such an interesting case, and it's another example of the law trying to keep up with technology. So the framers of the Constitution did not realize that public officials were going to have Twitter accounts. And so what happened in this district court case in Virginia is that a supervisor had a Facebook account, and she just really didn't like some of the comments she was getting, and she just blocked users. And one of those users sued. And what the court said, and I think this makes a lot of sense, is you had basically your Facebook page was like a town hall. And you don't get to throw people out of the town hall because you don't like what they say, because that's what we call in First Amendment jurisprudence, that's what we call viewpoint discrimination. Now, if you lit a fire in the town hall, we can ask you to leave because that's unsafe. But mm-hmm. that's not based on what you're saying. That's based on we don't all want to die in the town hall.
But what if a public official actually feels that he or she is unsafe, that someone is making really nasty, violent comments?
Well, at that point, it's a different case. And then you can go to law enforcement and say, look, I need to get a restraining order against this person, just as you would if they were stalking you mm-hmm. offline. So the cases that we're talking about, and I think that's a really good point, these are, my understanding is, people who have been critical but not threatening or legitimately dangerous. So the public officials aren't worried about going home at night. They just don't like what they're hearing. Mm. And this obviously has interesting implications for President Trump, who has two Twitter handles. One is the official POTUS handle that he inherited from President Obama, and one is his @RealDonaldTrump Twitter handle that he uses, as we all know, quite frequently. And so if his Twitter handle @RealDonaldTrump is considered what we call a limited public forum, basically meaning a place that the government has opened up for expressive purposes, then it's possible that he will not be able to continue to block people, because courts have said, if I want to interact with Donald Trump, or I want to be part of the conversation, or I want him to hear what I'm saying, or I just want to be able to, you know, communicate in this version of a town hall, like I want to have a follow-up question, let's say, then you don't get to block me. That infringes on my right because you didn't like what I said.
So how do we know if he'll unblock these Twitter followers?
Well, we don't know. And again, the federal case that we're talking about isn't dealing with Donald Trump. It's dealing with an official in Virginia. So if somebody already has sued Donald Trump on this basis, and so we don't know what that court will say, but there will be a lot of people coming out of the woodwork saying, he blocked me, he blocked me, he blocked me. And there must be some way for Twitter to try and help out if the court says you need to unblock these people.
He could, of course, delete his account entirely.
I don't see a universe in which his sticky fingers would allow that to happen. That's not a legal issue, but he could. But all of those things, I think, will not happen.
Well, speaking of, that raises another issue. I don't know if this has been dealt with, but do tweets count as official public records? And if he did delete his account, would that be a problem with that?
You're going to love this answer, which is it depends. There's interesting case law in California which indicates that social media communications can actually be public records. And so it depends on a couple of factors, like, are you Donald Trump or are you President Trump when you're making that tweet? And so courts will increasingly be answering this question, but we see this with respect to, there's questions in the courts right now about text messages, about email messages, about tweets, and are they covered under public records laws? And I think most people and most courts are coming to the conclusion that, yes, they are and they should be.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School, and you have a Twitter handle, right?
@LevinsonJessica, because somebody took Jessica Levinson. Not that I'm upset about it.
No, not at all. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, LA 2028. We'll talk about Los Angeles hosting the Olympics in 11 years next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. And it is official. We finally have word that the Summer Olympics are coming back to Los Angeles, but not until 2028. So let's kill the music. Yep. Thank you. Feels a little premature. The International Olympic Committee has been talking to L.A. and Paris for years, and it looks like Paris will get the Games in 2024. L.A. will host 4 years later. David Wharton is sports reporter for the L.A. Times, and he's here now. Hi.
Hi.
So Paris gets to go first. Why?
Well, Paris had, you know, it was just this summer that the IOC, which, you know, had two, what they thought were two very strong candidates in hand, decided they wanted to name dual winners. It's very unusual, but they wanted to give 24 and 28. LA said, we're willing to consider it. Paris, from the very beginning, had said, we want no part of waiting around another 4 years. So they had really pushed back, which kind of opened the way for negotiations between the IOC and LA.
Well, what does LA get for waiting?
It gets a little complicated in the crazy business of the Olympic Games, but it centers on four issues. There have been some changes in the way the IOC gives billions, or far more than $1 billion to host cities. And that's a share of all the revenue that they get from broadcasts like NBC and from corporate sponsors. For LA, they've reworked the distribution a little bit. So Paris would get $1.7 billion. In 2024, that total could jump to at least $2 billion for LA 4 years later. There have other in other parts of the contract, the IOC is waiving some of their normal fees and giving LA an advance of $180 million, which will do two things. It will cover the cost of running the LA Organizing Committee for an extra 4 years. And perhaps more importantly, it could pump as much as $160 million into youth sports programs around the city. Mayor Eric Garcetti was very insistent and has talked about this in public recently, that he wants the impact of these games to be felt right away, not just after they finish. And then finally, there's a fourth component that could actually end up being the most important, and that is if, in fact, LA is able to run these games on or under budget and generate a surplus like we did in 1984 when LA hosted the games, the IOC has waived their customary 20% grab on that. That could be $100 million when all is said and done, if, and it's a big if the games run on budget.
Right, because looking at other cities recently, that has been an impossible task, right?
Very impossible. But I would say that LA and even Paris, to a great extent, are very different kinds of bids that make it, that at least a lot of the people who have been following the Olympics over the years say it makes it far more likely that they can meet budget.
And it gives the city more time to complete building subways and things like that.
Right. And the endless refurbishment of LAX is supposed to be farther along with that extra 4 years.
Well, then doesn't it also give it time for mission creep, if you will, that the city will say, oh, well, the Olympics are coming, so let's approve even more infrastructure plans or more building plans or what have you?
That is always the biggest danger with the Olympics, and a lot of people outside the Games don't understand that. The Olympics actually almost pay for themselves in terms of running the Games and the revenue that you're pretty much guaranteed from TV and ticket sales and sponsors. It comes in around $5 to $6 billion, and you're pretty assured of covering that. Where we've seen all these cities in the past run into huge problems is exactly what you just mentioned. They say, oh, well, let's build this freeway. We need a new overpass. We need a new rail line. Let's build these hotels. That's where you get into $1 billion and more deficits. And so, yeah, that's four more years for that to happen. I mean, LA keeps promising, both the bid officials and city officials keep promising they won't do that, but they'll have a lot of time to be tempted.
Yeah, and then a lot of time for the resistance to build, I suppose, with more traffic. There's this group called No Olympics LA, and they're worried about traffic and safety issues.
Yeah, and in addition, they're concerned about the fact that, you know, a fair amount of effort and attention will be paid to what really amounts to a 17-day sporting event when we have so many other issues such as homelessness that are you know, to their point, more important to the city.
Well, is there any way to get some of that money for those issues, for building affordable housing, for example?
You know, I think that that's probably an opportunity for these opposition groups. No Olympics LA has kind of got a late start and is still relatively small, so we'll see. We haven't seen really any degree of opposition here in LA that we've seen in other cities. I mean, you know, people might forget, but 2 years ago, Boston was supposed to be the official U.S. candidate until the opposition there sank that bid and LA stepped in as a replacement. So, you know, there is time, I think, for opposition groups, but, you know, people are going to have to remain skeptical or to scrutinize this and you know, make their voices heard.
Well, you say that Boston dropped out and presumably other cities, well, Rome also dropped out. Is hosting the Olympics still a hot thing, a hot ticket? Do cities really, does it have the luster that it once had, or are cities kind of looking at it a little bit askance, given all the costs?
Yeah, I don't think it has the luster it had, say, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. I think, you know, the IOC has been fighting to stay relevant by adding new sports like, you know, BMX and things like that. I also think that we've kind of hit this point now where certain cities it makes sense. I mean, the reason that LA could conceivably do this in a financially responsible way is that they're not going to build any stadiums or arenas. There are already enough venues here to host all these events, and they're not going to build the expensive athletes' village. They're going to house all the athletes at UCLA. They'll house all the media at USC. All of that saves billions of dollars. So, yeah, I think cities are really looking twice at this, and there really may only be certain cities around the world, maybe as few as a handful, that are really in position to hold the Olympics in a responsible way.
Right. And this will be the third time LA has hosted the Olympics. And this would be also the third time for Paris, London three times, correct?
That's right. That's right.
So, and those are the only cities that have hosted it or will host it three times.
Yeah. And I think it gets back to that point that certain cities can pull this off, and a lot have learned that they either can't win the bid, or if they do, they're really facing huge financial risk.
Right. And so LA keeps looking back at 1984 as that was a great Olympics and it's still paying off dividends. Is that what they're hoping for 2028?
Yeah, I mean, they've built it a lot off of the same model. I think it's a very different circumstances. 84, they were able to get an even better deal in some ways with the IOC because LA was the only city in the running. If LA pulled out, there wasn't going to be a 1984 Summer Games. But it's built on this, you know, kind of really Peter Ubroth, who ran those Olympics, was known for being a real penny pincher, really tight fisted. And so far, at least, the kind of new LA bid committee has said that they want to build up those same ideas and make sure they cut costs as much as possible and work really hard in a way that Ubroth did to bring in domestic sponsorships and generate mm-hmm. as much money as possible.
Do we know how much it's going to cost?
Well, right now the budget is at about $5.3 billion, and that includes nearly $500 million in contingencies. That would be money that would be set aside to pay for any cost overruns. Now, if they run at the budget they've put forward, that $500 million, or almost $500 million, would convert automatically into a surplus, and that would, as we saw in 84, that's still paying for the foundation that has a lot to do with improving things for kids all around the city.
All right. Well, thanks so much, David.
My pleasure.
That's David Wharton. He's a sports reporter with the Los Angeles Times. And we want to hear from you. Are you excited about LA hosting the Olympic Games? Why or why not? Are you bummed out? We have to wait till 2028. You can weigh in on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, reinventing Google Glass.
What a tremendous irony that the original glass was thought of as sort of elitist nerds would go out into the world and people wanted to avoid them. And there was even a term for that.
We will not repeat that term. How Google Glass is used on factory floors. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Remember Google Glass, those wraparound glasses that let you live in the real and virtual world at the same time? Well, as you probably recall, they were a major dud because people were creeped out that the glasses could be used to secretly take pictures and video. No one wanted to be seen with those things on. Plus, they were not very attractive. So Google's parent company, Alphabet, was all set to let Google Glass die. But meanwhile, the company was unaware that the glasses were being used, far from any hipster hangout, on factory floors. Stephen Levy is editor-in-chief of Back Channel, and he's written about Google Glass 2.0. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline.
So you visited this factory in Jackson, Minnesota, where they build farm equipment, and they were one of the early adopters of Google Glass. Tell us how they use it.
You're right. I visited this factory in rural Minnesota. They built tractors. They also built big sprayers and other farm equipment. And they use it on the assembly line. Each worker has a number of tasks to do. It's usually broken up into hour-long or 70-minute segments and then broken down into steps. And Glass walks them through those steps. They say, okay, Glass, proceed. And it tells them what the next step is, where they might want to put the bolts in, what parts to get, even what amount of torque to put when they screw in a bolt.
How was this discovered, that Google Glass could be used and used well, you know, on factory floors in manufacturing?
Well, in this case, some of the people working there at the factory, looking for ways to improve the workflow, saw the opportunity to improve on a problem they had, which was because each tractor is custom built by the customer and often needs different parts on at different times. And people had to go sometimes walk across the floor for 50, 60 feet to consult on the laptop. They tried tablets and people would drop them. And you know, so that wasn't a good solution. So they thought, well, maybe we'll try this as a way to keep the information on in real time, where workers wouldn't have to leave the station to know what comes next. And they used the Glass Explorer Edition, which was meant for people to test it out. You know, Google sort of hedged its bets by releasing Glass originally in something called the Explorer Edition, which sort of had built-in idea that you were taking a big risk of doing it and you keep your expectations low. But they tested it out and they thought this is pretty good. And a number of places in these kinds of businesses, warehouses, factories, other workplace situations, started using this informally, working with people who wrote software for it and helped them. And when Google found out about this, they thought, wow, here's maybe we should reinvent Glass for the workplace. And they went back to Google's research division, X, which used to be called Google X. Now it's an Alphabet company called X. And they developed a new version of Glass that's optimized for the workplace. It's more powerful. It has a better network connection because you can't afford to drop it when you're on the factory floor there and it's part of your workflow. And you know, for the first time also, a light goes on when you take a video, which is something that people using the original Glass might have appreciated.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of funny that this was originally envisioned as a toy for, you know, white collar workers, I guess, not something to be used in the workplace necessarily. And it seems to have been reinvigorated, breathed new life into in a blue collar setting. So what kind of lesson is there in terms of technology and who it's designed for and who it works for?
Yeah, you put your finger on it. What a tremendous irony that the original Glass was thought of as sort of elitist nerds would go out and into the world and people wanted to avoid them. And there was even a term for that, which I don't think I'm going to repeat here. But
yeah, we all know that term.
but this is the total opposite. It's not something that distances people from, you know, those in their surroundings, but something that focuses them on the job. And you know, one complaint about the original Glass from people around it was you would be interacting with someone wearing that and they would sort of drift off. You'd see the eyeballs flutter and they were getting a message or looking at a tweet and, or something like that, checking out a baseball score. And this is just focused on one thing. The only thing that this version of Glass is called the Glass Enterprise Edition does is that one application that does your work there. So it's sort of ironic that the original problem of Google Glass has been flipped around, and now it's a focus machine rather than a distraction machine. So I think the lesson, to finally answer your question, is that sometimes you don't know what you have. You don't know what the best use of what you have is. And this is something we see in technology and over again. There's even a term for it called the pivot. And in this case, Glass had to pivot to something else. And Google or Alphabet learned a very costly lesson because they spent a lot of money promoting and a lot of capital, let's say reputation capital, getting behind the thing before they understood what it could do and what it was best at.
Right. And that it was embraced by a group of people they didn't really envision would embrace it, but also that they learned from that, right? They were like, oh, okay, so this is happening. We need to adjust. So that also shows that they were pretty nimble.
Yeah, and they explicitly say that. They say, you know, because I was pressing them and saying, well, are you going to revive the consumer version of it? And they said, whoa, we've learned our lesson. We're just going to stick to this for a little while and not talk about plans for, you know, bringing back this on the street. Let's make this work first.
Stephen Levy, editor-in-chief of Back Channel, a weekly digital magazine published by Wired. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up in the program, we will remember Sam Shepard, a voice of the West, and that iconic French voice, Jean Moreau, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
It takes a special kind of man to volunteer for a suicide mission, especially when it's on TV.
Sam Shepard as pilot Chuck Yeager in the 1983 film The Right Stuff. It was a role made for Shepard, an injured cowboy who becomes the first man on Earth to fly at supersonic speeds. He earned an Oscar nomination for that role, but it was Sam Shepard's plays, all 44 of them, along with his short stories, screenplays, and essays that won most of the awards, a Pulitzer among them. Shepard has died at the age of 73 from Lou Gehrig's disease, and here to tell us more about him is John Winters. He's the author of the book, Sam Shepard, A Life. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Thank you for having me.
Well, great to have you. New York Magazine described Sam Shepard as the greatest American playwright of his generation. And he got his start off Broadway in the early 1960s. How did he break into the theater scene?
He arrived in New York City, and he was actually began working in the jazz club, the Village Gate, and he was there, met a bunch of waiters and the host, who were actually all wannabes as far as acting and writing, and they eventually got together and began working at Theater Genesis, which was over at St. Mark's on the Bowery Church in the East Village, and Sam was one of their first playwrights, and that's where he got his start, writing one-act plays. And his plays stood out from the people I interviewed from those days, was mostly because they were so alive, was the word they kept saying over and over again. And he took off pretty quickly from that after just a couple of years.
Yeah, he won a bunch of Obies, right?
Exactly. He won 11, 12, 13 of them, yes. Yeah. And of course, when he did the family plays in beginning in 1978, that would lead to the Pulitzer for Buried Child.
Right. Well, tell us about that one and how he came up with the idea for that play, Buried Child.
Barry Child is actually based on a visit he actually took to his family home with his first girlfriend. He'd already moved to New York, and he came back to the family home. And so the play, if you've seen the play, it involves a young man who comes home, and none of his family recognizes him. And things get a little stranger from there. Mm-hmm. And Shepard took that visit and turned it into something gothic and kind of strange, but powerful all the same.
Yeah. Well, he often dealt with very dark themes, the dark sides of family life, the dark sides of masculinity, of nostalgia for something that perhaps never existed, ideas of places like the West, like Hollywood. And he said he never believed in happy endings. Can you tell us a bit more about his vision and how he brought it to light in plays like True West, for example?
Exactly. I always say that if Williams, Miller, and O'Neill burst the bubble on the idea of the happy American family, that Shepard came along afterward and buried it. He didn't do hope. He didn't believe in happy endings, as you said. And if his plays were, they were never really naturalistic, but they were very realistic at heart. He hit upon the things that you know, people who feel disenfranchised and people who feel like an outsider in their own family. He brought those onto the stage. And a lot of that comes from his own life. He grew up with a father who was an alcoholic, and Sam caught the brunt of his abuse and desperation. And the family plays all involve the father figure, whether he is alive or dead, and he's always haunting the family. And those are the plays that really made his name.
And Sam Shepard grew up in Duarte?
Actually, he always said Duarte, and everybody says Duarte, but it's actually in the town right over the line in Bradbury, which was more of an agricultural community. He did go to the regional high school in Duarte and hung out with his friends there. So, you know, give or take.
And so how did he view Southern California?
He viewed it as a place that he had to get out of as a young man to escape. And, of course, he did. He made his way across the country to New York when he was about 18, 19, and made his name. But in his work, he always returned to that area. He did grow up as a child who worked on in his family farm. It was really a house with an orchard next door to it. But he did. He worked the land, and he always had horses and animals. So he really did come from that kind of background. And he grew to love the land, and that played an important role in his work.
Yeah. Yeah, he said he never felt more comfortable than when he was in the West. And like moving east, he felt a little out of his skin. But he really didn't like the whole Hollywood scene. And yet he was a bit of a movie star, right?
He was. It's funny, if you look at his movies, there are the roles, if you go through his archives, you can see the film scripts that were actually the ones he worked from. And the movies he cares about, the meticulous notes written all over them about how to feel, how to think about the role. And, you know, there's probably about a dozen of those. And then, of course, the other 40 or so. And those were really what I would call paycheck movies. So he was able to compartmentalize the movies that meant a lot to him. And the other ones that he did, well, he had to pay the rent. He had a lot of bills to pay. He was quite a horseman. He had a large stable of horses and, of course, an active life. So he was able to compartmentalize that, which was very interesting to me. Not saying he was never, he was always good in the films, but you could always tell the ones which meant the most to him. But he definitely was not a Hollywood type of guy. You never saw him on the talk shows. He's not on Twitter. He's not on the red carpet. He'd much rather be in the saddle of a horse.
Let's play a little clip of tape of him acting in Fool for Love opposite Kim Basinger.
Look, what to do? She's gonna come back here.
No, she's thinking.
We gotta get out of here. We gotta get your stuff.
Stop it! Don't you dare put me up like this! This is your mess, it's not. Let me down!
Look, I came here to get you. What's the matter with you?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so yeah, a lot of domestic violence, as you've talked about in his work. But he was also interested in the bigger idea of violence in American culture.
Indeed he was. And that was a thing that I think, and Harold Pinter did this a lot too. He could just, there was always this unease at the center of his plays. And you never knew when something or somebody was going to erupt. True West is a great example of that. This is four or five times the two brothers at the center of the play, you expect them to come to blows. Even at the end, it ends in a famous stare out. You know, they're kind of staring off at each other, and you don't want to know what's coming next as the curtain goes down. So that was an important part for him, that he felt there was a violence in American life. And he came of age in the 60s. You know, when the 68 and the assassinations, in Vietnam, of course, too. So he grew up along that Mitzet Melu.
I just want to quote something that I read that he, in an interview that he gave to Michiko Kakutani of the New York Times back in the 80s, he said, "I think there's something about American violence that to me is very touching. In full force, it's very ugly, but there's also something very moving about it because it has to do with humiliation." And so did he think that the American male, the white Anglo male, had been humiliated, I guess, by the force of history in some way?
Yeah, it's a perplexing quote when you think about it. You know, you know, sometimes I wonder if the humiliation may be reflecting on his own past. He did deal with his own demons on the stage, and you got to think back to his father. In every interview, he mentions his father. In every short story collection, the father is a character. In his archives, I found a journal entry where he talked about still flinching when he thought about his father. This is a man who was 60 years old at that time, and so that's quite an impact. So that quote may come directly from the experience of growing up with that kind of father.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and memories of Sam Shepard with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's John Winters. He's the author of Sam Shepard, A Life. And I want to play another clip from Shepard's play True West with Gary Sinise as writer Austin living in suburban Arizona and John Malkovich as his older brother, the wannabe writer Lee.
Hey. It's the dumbest story I ever heard in my life.
Hold on. That's my story you're talking about.
No, it's a bull story. It's idiotic. Two lame brains chasing each other across Texas. Are you kidding? Who do you think's going to go see a film like that?
It's not a film. It's a movie. There is a big, big difference, Austin. That is something Saul told me.
Oh, he did, huh?
Yeah. He said, in this business, we make movies. American movies. Leave the films to the French.
Well, we couldn't find a better transition if we tried to. Another remembrance of death to mention today. French film would not be what it is without Jeanne Moreau. Moreau was the face of the French New Wave. She starred in Louis Malle's The Lovers and François Truffaut's Jules and Jim.
Elle avait des yeux d'opale qui me fascinaient, y avait l'ovale de son visage pâle, de femme fatale qui me fut fatale, de femme fatale qui me fut fatale.
Well, whether singing or not, she epitomized the women of French film, slinked in a chair, cigarette hanging out of her mouth, effortlessly cool. In The Lovers, she played a bored housewife having an affair. It was so scandalous at the time. In 1958, it was banned in the United States. Jeanne Moreau kept acting late into her life, winning awards into the 1990s. She was married twice. She had a son, but she never lost her je ne sais quoi. Here she is talking to Charlie Rose in 2002.
When you talk about ego, you see in your mouth the word sounds disgusting.
Ego.
As though it was ego.
Ego,
ego is beautiful. Yeah. You have to have a little just to face the world. It's difficult to live.
Yeah.
And you have to have belief in yourself. Otherwise, you wouldn't be as crazy as to decide that all your life you're going to portray people that were born in the mind of somebody else.
And you've got to go and give life to it on the cinema.
Yeah. You know, you have to have something crazy somewhere.
Jeanne Moreau, talking to Charlie Rose. She died today at the age of 89. Okay, that is from the soundtrack to Elevator to the Gallows by Louis Malle, which she starred. And Christian Bordahl is here now to give us a little bit of
Madeline.
Hi.
So reached out to some of our listeners to see what they had to say about Sam Shepard's passing.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Healy said he's going to remember Sam Shepard for True West, the great play. Melissa Hernandez is going to remember him for the great movie Days of Heaven, you know, that great Terrence Malick movie that I think was one of his first on-screen performances. Jim Feenstra says country is underrated and also the right stuff. And, you know, there was a documentary about Sam Shepard that came out a few years ago. Shepard and Dark, it was called. It was about his relationship with a good friend of his over many years. I missed that, but I'm definitely going to go back and check it out now.
Also great to reread the parts of Just Kids with, you know, written by Patti Smith about her relationship.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. While he was married.
Yes. Slight detail there. But they had a very long, fruitful, creative partnership as well.
A pretty cool couple.
Yeah, the coolest couple. All right, Christian Bordahl, thank you very much. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.